Hello and welcome to Tell the Damn Story, the podcast that explores the joys and challenges of being creative so that you can more easily tell your own damn story.
Hi, Alex. Long time no see.
Yeah.
Hi,
a little bit longer then. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Chris Ryan. I'm a wandering author trying to find my place in the world.
And I'm Alex Simmons, who's been around since the first rock, and I wrote on it. So there you go.
I tell you what.
Let's get the old man jokes out of there.
He is a legend, ladies and gentlemen. This is a guy who, well, he may or may not have written on those rocks, and Moses may or may not have picked them up. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
Moses was pretty cool. He was a down brother, you know.
He's
this is Chris Ryan
up,
over here, by the way, who constantly every season compliments
me. We're in a competition this week, ladies and gentlemen.
On infinitum, he compliments me while downplaying his accomplishments, and he's got a couple to mention this week as well.
But not mentioned in a word. I'm just talking about Alex Simmons.
No.
Yes, I am.
Chris Ryan too. We're gonna just battle the compliments. This.
I think what we need to say is that
what do we
this
need
is
to
no
say?
Way to conduct ourselves during a podcast.
Yeah, but ladies we're doing it anyway because
welcome.
It's our show.
Ladies and
how
gentlemen,
how are you, Chris? Go ahead, try it again.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Tell the Damn Story. I apologize for the first 2 minutes of tomfoolery. We will try and be much more serious for the rest of this episode because we have a work of art to talk about that is worth our respect and our experienced view on what it was accomplished. So please, let's let Alex Simmons introduce today something we can all learn about. When there's something this excellent, if you're serious about writing, if you're serious about telling the damn story, you go out and you watch and you look at how well it was done. And you get new ideas on how to do your own stuff.
That's right.
And that's what are we here to celebrate,
Alex?
We're
here to talk about a Filmation phenomenon. I don't mean the company Filmation, but an animation phenomenon that covered all the bases as a dynamite script, excellent storytelling, great visual experience. We're talking about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
That's
right. Absolutely well-told story from beginning to end, and it touched on, and I don't mean just in the heart, I mean, but no, really, it touched on so many wonderful techniques of storytelling, both in the written form, but also in the visual form. And so we're gonna tap into some of that, and we might even talk about comparisons, like why we feel this was so good as opposed to some things that we wish that had been better.
Well, but let's first talk about, oh God, the absolute banquet, the absolute feast of what went right with this movie. And if you are out there as one of those jaded comic movie fans, you have come to the wrong place. We're not talking about this in terms of fandom. We're talking about this in terms of telling the story. Written on the page, acted by the actors, but mostly the visual storytelling, where they use different techniques to make people move in slightly different ways and at different speeds to give them a different sense of reality. And they use the color palette to help tell the story in fully in terms of mood and in terms of beauty in ways atmosphere in ways that it just refreshes storytelling. The music, yes, all of that.
Well, I mean, first we have a great story in Miles Morales. Miles was introduced to the comic book world as another Spider-Man, you know, the Spider-Man in this alternate universe. And he's a combination of Black and Hispanic in terms of his cultural background. And he was younger when he first entered the game. And so in the first Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse movie, I think he was maybe 3 years younger or 2 years younger. So all of his adventure at that point was, it was all kind of still very new to him. He was meeting new characters. He was suddenly being introduced to the alternate Spider-Mans. There was a lot of it that was like big-eyed, sort of wide and wonder, and how can I possibly handle all this? And then there was the subplot of his dealing with his family and really handling all of that. Now you would think that, okay, since they did all of that in the first movie, where do you go in the second movie? Well, you go a couple of years later. He's just a little bit older, but just like in life, you become an older teenager, you still have things to deal with. You still have choices to make. You're still trying to figure out where you fit in the world. You're still trying to figure out who you connect to in the world. And so that part of the story was there and very fully explored, both in his relationships with friends, potential love interests, and his family and his culture and community. So that was just a wonderful bed on which all of the superhero crazy world jumping took place. So that was one of the things I just wanted to say about that.
Yeah, and from the very beginning of this movie, they set a major theme, you know, that as we get, you know, this is in terms of teenagerness, we're a little older than that, but as you get a sense of self, the black and whiteness of youth, either you can do something or you can't do something, either something is right or something is wrong, becomes much more complicated. And the thrill of being Spider-Man is textured with responsibilities in school, his expectations of his family, his dreams, and having the absolute wonderfulness of a kid from Brooklyn dreaming so big that he could dream about going all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. I just think that is so fantastic. And yes, you know, it that little moment is, you know, when he reveals that he wants to go to Princeton and his parents freak out because they don't want him to leave the city or the neighborhood. Right? Yeah. The idea that he would dream that high because Princeton has a great reputation and have the dreams of wanting to be a scientist, and it being all across one river, you know, and it sets him because in his Miles Morales world, that's the boundaries, you know. Can he go beyond the love of his family and attain dreams without sacrificing family, right?
Right.
And the dreams are just as wide as either side of the Hudson.
Right.
But his Spider-Man identity is going to blow through multiple universes, the multiverse. And by the way, this is how you do a multiverse. You know, Marvel Cinematic Universe has had several cracks of the apple. And Spider-Man Far From Home, I think, did really, really well. And Multiverse of Men.
Yeah, right. The Doctor Strange film. Yeah, the Doctor Strange. We'll talk about that.
But that this so contrasts his two lives and how he's trying so hard to both be his own man as Miles and still be in his family as Miles, and then discovering a family as Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And while Miles is worried about risking tearing that family apart, Spider-Man's family is both being torn apart and being shattered into literally a million pieces at one point in the movie.
Fragmented like crazy.
Fascinating.
I just wanted to comment to piggyback off of what you were saying. You know, when you and I talk to our students or we talk about writing and creating characters, compelling characters in particular, we always talk about where we pull from, how we pull from life in order to help us mold these fictional characters into someone that real people can connect to. And, you know, the whole thing of just of you know, what do you do when your family, you've grown up in this sort of nice little cocoon. It's not like they've been denying you a look at the world, but the world that they know has been very, very sort of set in a certain series of maybe a certain neighborhood, a certain community, a certain cultural difference, whatever. And they want the best for you. But in their minds, the best for you doesn't take you too far from them. And yet the kid, you know, male, female, whatever, is seeing the next possibility beyond that. And it is, you know, this has happened in real life. I know this has happened with my kids and your kids, you know, so a lot of the young people that we've met over the years as teachers who come from other countries or other neighborhoods or communities or states. And they're stretching out there. They're reaching out there to see where they fit in the world and to see if they can acquire or obtain the dreams that they've had, you know, smoldering in their mindset for so many years. So, you know, this movie didn't forget any of that and built beautifully off of that. Right. Yes, it's got fantastic characters and wild worlds and all this kind of craziness in it. But at the heart of it, again, the core is a human condition that's very universal that many, many, many people in the audience could connect to. And so again, you know, when Chris and I talk about connecting to what you know, connecting to the things you've seen in the real world in order to help you build up your fictional world, you know, we're not the only ones who follow that particular pathway.
Right. Well, you're right on all of that, but you kept mentioning the word character, and I would very much like to take some time to just focus on how this movie presents character, because we're always telling people to tell a damn story. It's character in action, right? Mm-hmm. And with character, intention versus obstacle or opposition. And that's fantastic. And if you can manage it, surprise, right? Mm-hmm. So what's the most surprising way to open up a Miles Morales Spider-Man movie? Well, first 5 minutes, make it a Spider-Gwen movie. And what we get to see in this opening of this movie is Spider-Gwen, right? Spider-Woman, Gwen Stacy of another universe, who she's the one who got the powers. And what we see is, as unique as she is and as wonderful a character as she is, she's got a dad who she fights with and who she loves and who loves her. And he's about to be made captain. And it doesn't make, you know, we first read that as, oh, okay, she's going to worry about whether she's going to make the ceremony or have to do Spider-Woman stuff. And it'll come back, you know, to pay off much later. But what a refreshing and bold way to start telling the story of Miles Morales by opening with a contrast, right? Or a comparison. Because everybody who came in and sat down had probably rewatched Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and had reminded themselves of the glory that is Miles. And then we see her being glorious. And it leads directly to Miles. And we see how close they are. We see the fragileness of their response. You know, they are attracted, but she won't because she lost her Peter. So he won't because he doesn't want to screw things up with the friendship, and he has respect and all those little things. And you get to see these two characters as they're beginning, and they're beginning to own themselves, know themselves, and be able to really function as spider people. And it's a wonderful thing that she came to visit, came to his reality, just to visit him. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yep.
And then, whoop, it's a lie.
Yep. Yep. They flipped.
She wasn't supposed to see him, and the slow revelation of what Miles Morales really is to the spider multiverse. It's fantastic, and it speaks to something that all writers go through, which is imposter syndrome. Spider-Man is told he's not both as Miles Morales.
By the way,
Spider-Man.
Alert here. Spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the movie and you don't want
to. Maybe you should. We're speaking around it, but maybe you should go. Just hold off. Go and see it and come on back to it.
Just to let you know.
He's being told that he can't be what he wants to be as Miles Morales. And then he starts getting told that he can't be what he wants to be as Spider-Man. And it's even that you're not supposed to this. You suck. And my God, how many teenagers and young people have been told, no, you can't.
Yep.
You don't understand. You don't know what you're doing, kid.
Yeah.
Holy shit. And that's by Miguel. I forget his last name, the Spider 2099.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could have played him off as a two-dimensional villain. But to make the same losses, his version of the same losses that make Spider-Man, Spider-Man, make him so obsessive. We see the obsessiveness in all the Spider-Man. And that he's so desperately trying to protect everything by dealing with the multiverse. And he's kind of made a spider army to deal with the multiverse. Really cool.
You know, I think one of the things I'd like to point out to you, because you're talking about characters, is the way that this particular film and its predecessor really takes different animation styles and uses those different styles for the different Spider-Men that we meet, or spider characters that we meet, and blend it into one film. So it's not like you've got, you know, let's just say, for lack of a better description, you've just got straight CGI, you know, from one end to the other. Everybody looks like they're a part of the same world. We are definitely not in Kansas anymore when we go from one world to the next. And the art style changes so drastically. And I think one thing that I can bring up that's not a spoiler alert, because they've done articles all across the internet about it, is the Lego segment,
right,
which is totally different from any of the other animation segments within the same film. But there's this action sequence of Spider-Man, who's a Lego Spider-Man in his Spider-Verse world, and that two things: one, phenomenally done, well done, fun, blends right in with everything else, and that segment was produced by a 14-year-old non-pro.
How cool is that?
That is just one, because I saw a picture of him, and in a way, he reminds me of Miles.
You know? Yeah.
Like, you know, what a wonderful blending of the universes to have in reality. A young man, 14-year-old, who gets to create a Spider-Man world that actually winds up in the movie.
What he had done is he took the first trailer, and he did a Lego version of that, and it went viral. And that's how they saw him. And they said, let's let him do, just, it could fit, you know, as a moment. And it made perfect sense. It was seamless. It was great. And then to have this as a story, again, they let him tell his damn story, which was really cool.
Yep. And it says a lot about creativity and, you know, just letting the mind just go and having fun with it.
There's something for everything, for everyone, every writer to see in here. And one of our good friends did such an amazing video that I have to shout him out.
Okay.
Omar Holman. You know him.
Yes, yes, yes.
He did a video about this movie where it's funny. At one point, he says, "That's how you cinema." But he points out that on one level, this movie is about the question or the test of allyship. Mm-hmm. Because Quinn does him really dirty by not telling him
what the circumstances really are. Yeah.
And so does Peter Parker.
Yeah.
Peter B. Parker. However, to quote Omar Holman, the brothers
and a sister
back him up.
Yep.
You know, because we have Spider-Punk, who is amazing character and so cool. And when he pulls
his... a little Rasta, man. Just a little
bit. Yeah, when he pulls off his mask, he's got a big Rasta dreadlocks and all that stuff, and just so cool. But Omar points out he's on screen for seconds. The first couple of seconds he's there, he explains how Miles can do something just by changing the position of his hand. He'll do it better. Quote Omar. He was looking out for young brother from the very first, as soon as he sets eyes on him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And and then he gives him what he needs and then quits, showing him you can be independent, you can make your own rules. And when Peter's trying to do something in what we'll say is a very large computer lab, like you said, it was a sister.
Yep.
Who without hesitation defied the boss, Miguel, and helped him out.
Yep.
You know, and people say, well, she sent him to the wrong place. No, the computer recognized the spider elements in him and sent him where that spider came from. It wasn't her, it was the computer.
Yep.
I know if you haven't seen the film, you're really confused here. But if you have seen...
And you should be, so go see the movie.
what you're seeing here is ethnic loyalty, people who have been judged because of their skin color, people who understand that Miguel doesn't know where he's going, what he's doing at this moment in this multiverse where hundreds of spider people are chasing him. Here's how you have to do this, you know?
Well, but you know, you find your allegiances. You know, these things are formed. And again, very much like in real life. And again, as Chris, and if you haven't read Genius High, you should. Very much as Chris even illustrates in one of his books, with high school students being the protagonist. Alliances are formed, allegiances are formed, relationships are formed, and truths and questions are tested. And sometimes there's split-second decisions have to be made based on gut instinct.
And always, always, always figuring out who you are and how you function in the world.
Yep. Okay? Yep.
And we see that in Genius High. Yes, we do. But we also see this in Across the Universe.
A damn good writer, God damn it.
Well, give me about a week. A new edition of that is coming out. It's completely rewritten. And when you mean rewritten and improved, that means you've dropped about 50 pages. Of just paragraph by paragraph, line by line, making the sentences better, making the paragraphs better, making the story better.
Serving the story, as Chris is fond of.
We got a new cover. Everything is served, and I can't wait to serve it up to you. But right now, I want to serve Across the Universe, Across the Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
It's when Miles has to recalibrate who he's loyal to, who's not loyal to, and he sees that almost everybody is against him, even if they still love him, even if they're trying to support him, their subscription to or acceptance of a truth about him, it makes them less helpful than they could mm-hmm. be. And it's amazing. It is. You can see it in the trailer and you still don't know what's coming. When one of the most insanely entertaining and brilliantly wrought chase scenes I've ever seen. When that happens, all the chaos that happens, Miles has a plan. It's really cool to see.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we want to ruin the
movie. I don't think we should. The chase scene in itself is exciting.
But the payoff.
What it does is remarkable. Absolutely.
The payoff, if I can just finish the point.
Yeah.
The payoff shows us, oh, that's how you do character. Here's where he began, and here's the climax for the character. Maybe not for the movie, but for the character. Brilliant. And, you know, the first movie was an origin story of Miles into Spider-Man. This is an origin story of Spider-Man into, I don't care what anyone else says, my name is Miles Morales. I was bitten by a radioactive spider. I know who I am. It's such a powerful moment.
Yeah.
Go on. You go. I'm going to shut up for a while.
Well, I just want to say that, again, you should go see the movie. Even with what we said, there's so much more to take in. Yeah. And really, as a comparison, I wanted to bring up, and Chris and I talked about this a little bit before the show in the green room, as it were, one looks at how well this film worked on so many levels. And one of the things that when you're trying to teach or get people at least to look at the pros and cons of what we do, of how to construct a good story, you have to point out what doesn't work in maybe another project so that there's some checks and balances here. And for me, the Doctor Strange multiverse movie was probably the one that was most problematic. Because, I mean, first off, I'm a big Benedict Cumberbatch fan. You know, I loved him in Sherlock. I liked him in the Star Trek, reboot with Chris Pine, where he plays Khan. He was powerful in that. He's powerful in a number of other films. So the man can bring his A game any day of the week.
He played Smaug.
Yeah, I absolutely love him as Doctor Strange. He looks the part, and he has that presence, and he can play humor and all that. It's wonderful. But the movie was all over the place.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to have a true direction, even with, okay, Strange is a good guy, Wanda's a bad guy. What happens? Wanda's goal, okay, was better handled in WandaVision. And Strange's countering to that seemed to be, again, unclear. And every now and then it felt like they plugged something else in because it would look cool, or it would be, oh, this would be a great challenge point here. But it didn't feel like the story, the heart of the story, was really being served throughout.
And it was almost
like with the DC Batman movie with
George Clooney.
Mr. Freeze and a bunch of other guys.
George Clooney, like, Batman and Robin.
Yeah, right. We got great merchandising possibilities here. Let's throw as many people in here as possible. But the movie just became convoluted. And right. I think, you know, again, knowing that the MCU knows how to do a good movie, I think right. that they somehow got tremendously lost with the multiverse. And we did not get to see the Doctor Strange character go on this hero's journey and wind up where he needed to be in that. Nor did, I think it was Ms. Marvel. That character also got bounced around a little bit. It was a little convoluted.
No, that was America.
Excuse me?
That was America Chavez.
Right, America Chavez. Again, but doesn't she have, yeah, you know, again.
She does have powers, but she's a different character.
Yeah, I know. Not Captain Marvel.
And not Ms. Marvel.
She's got a Marvel name, though, doesn't she?
No, the one in Doctor Strange was America Chavez. That is the name of the character. Okay. Ms. Marvel had her own miniseries, and she will eventually be in the movie The Marvels with the other Captain Marvel-esque characters.
Okay.
She's from this century. She's only maybe 15, 20 years old at most in the comic book.
I'll take my schooling on that.
Assistance. But it is, yeah, she can travel through different realities, different. Yeah, that's
America Chavez could.
America Chavez could. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So again, her character did not seem to get, was not served the way that, again, clearly we could see the growth and the development of the character as clearly as I felt it could have been. And it's just, again, the movie just sort of seemed to bump into itself a lot during the process.
I have a theory.
Okay.
Anyone who watches and happened to go to the high school where I used to teach, and maybe were in the plays, then they know what my concept is here. Marvel worked really hard and really diligently to deliver a movie history in the first 20 some odd movies, where it was a continuing connected universe that eventually all led up to this huge two-part movie, right? And it was big and glorious and all that stuff. Think of that as the first night of the spring play in high school, where all these months of practice and all these attempts to be these things pay off in a, you know, auditorium full of people who are already going to applaud from the very beginning and are shocked at how good you are. And just like Marvel fans were so thrilled from Iron Man on, this is going to be great. And then the second night performance comes in and everybody just comes in still high off that, you know, ovation at the end of the first night's play. And they think that it's just going to be like that again. And I always had to talk to him and say, that was last night. That's gone. You got to start all over again and earn that honestly. Because if you don't tell them that, they go out and they don't get that first laugh, or they don't get, and then they freak out, you know, or they go out and they're a little cocky and they screw up the scene and all that stuff. I think in Doctor Strange, Multiverse of Madness, and in Thor Love and Thunder, we saw that happen. I thought this phase opened up interesting with this really huge dramatic storytelling risk. We're going to do a bunch of these different miniseries, you know, these little TV series on Disney+, and everyone's going to be in mourning. Even Black Panther is going to be awake, you know. Spider-Man Far From Home, a good chunk of it was awake and trying to not own the loss, denying the loss. It was all of this entire phase had been about loss. And then, whether it was Feige's indulgence or whatever, hire Sam Raimi, who is not invested in the 25 movie buildup and not in on the wake deal, and just really kind of regurgitates his own greatest hits. And Feige loves Sam Raimi so much, he doesn't call him on it. And that's where we get this second night failure. You know, it falls flat. There are things that knock us out of the story, and you know how that's a cardinal sin for me. You know, the actor who played in Army of Darkness showing up, that, you know, that's just because he used to do it in the Spider-Man movies too, and it worked then, but it doesn't work now. And they didn't work hard enough on it. And they didn't make this dark enough. If you really go into the multiverse of madness, then play with madness. And it wasn't. We never felt insanity in the whole movie. We, you know, she seemed really angry, Wanda, and she seemed really determined to get kids. But there was no one, you know, there was no one who could stop her. Nobody stops her. She stops herself, or the kids stop her, because they touch her heart. Well, then that turns out to be a boring movie. You finally put that guy in as Reed Richards. You bring back Xavier. You have other characters line up. The British Miss America, the Captain America version that Haley Atwell plays. You bring all of that. One of the Captain Marvel who was in WandaVision, you know, that version. I don't know if she has a name yet as far as superhero name.
She does.
And then,
I don't have it in my head.
Yeah, I forget it. And you dispatch them all in moments. That's not good storytelling. You know, it's cashing in on Easter eggs. Easter eggs aren't enough to tell a story. An oh moment is not enough. And if you respected these characters, you wouldn't have turned Reed Richards into spaghetti or Play-Doh in seconds. You wouldn't have cut Haley Atwell in half. These are not things that the fan base wanted to see. It's what the negatives, the naysayers, the complainers of the social media, ripped them apart. But it didn't advance the story. It knocked you out of the story. And that's why if you're looking to really learn how to tell a story, yes, look at one really great one. Really great one. Like Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And then look at a couple of failed ones. Doctor Strange, Multiverse Madness is one. And there's others we could name for them to go and see. Yeah, see bad movies.
Right. let me also say, you know, because I know
you learn more.
Some folks sitting out there going, "What's wrong with you? It was a great movie." You know, I'm glad you enjoyed Doctor Strange, and I'm glad you enjoyed Love and Thunder and all that. That's great. As storytellers, we're looking at it differently. We're looking at it in terms of what it was and what it could have been, and we see certain aspects of it that don't work for us. And, you know, again, was I on the team to write it? No. You know, and so I don't have a say in how it comes out. Feige has not called me. I don't expect him to. But I can still sit and look at the story.
That's a mistake, Feige.
You know, what can I tell you? You know, I can sit and look at that the way I can sit and look at any other movie. I can enjoy a movie. There's plenty of B movies or C movies that I've watched and chuckled or just enjoyed this, you know, just had a good time with it. Didn't need to be perfect, wonderful, brilliant, any of that. But again, when we're looking at how to tell the story, you have to look at what did and did not work.
And if that's why we're here. Well.
And right. I think, again, Spider-Verse, you know, this one, Into the Spider-Verse, just really worked on so many levels.
Yeah.
So many levels in terms of character development, in terms of action adventure, in terms of visual stimulation. Yeah. There's visual cues, visual story bits that are going on in this film that if you're too busy looking at your raisinettes and your popcorn, you're going to miss.
Miss it, right.
Yep.
But like we were talking about how the Easter eggs detract from the storytelling in Multiverse of Madness. But if you look at it across the Spider-Verse, they add to the storytelling organically.
Yep.
And that is the goal. Even if you look at the subtle different color palettes, you know, when you go to Spider-Gwen's world, she kind of lives in the world. I heard it on one of the videos. They told her that she lives in a world that's kind of like a mood ring for her.
Yeah.
Right? With different colors. So you see when she hugs her father, the background colors, the pastels, change just subtly. And all of that is well thought out. How can we tell this story, this character who is dynamic and authentic and has intention, and then here are the obstacles. And sometimes obstacles are as little and as small as, I want my dad safe. Oh my God, he just says something. He doesn't realize how safe he is now, you know, and that hug. By the way, Miles Morales, Spider-Man, those two movies, more hugs than in the entire MCU. Okay, the rest of it, the whole rest of the MCU combined, not nearly as many hugs as in these two movies.
which says something about relationships and families in terms of the themes of this of these films. Of these
blood family and found family. Yeah, very much.
Yeah. All right. Well,
what else do you want to
covered that? No, I was going to say I think we covered that. But what did you want to add to it, sir?
My next thing was going to be: do we need to talk about another bad example? Do we want to just drop some names? Is that enough?
I think you drop Love and Thunder.
Right. Yep. I would say all the Fantastic Four movies so far, which is fascinating because this was the first family of Marvel. Mm. And, you know, again, say what you want about Stan and Jack and who did what. But one thing they did great blueprints. Everything you need for a great movie is in there.
Yep.
All the four great characters that are standalone and are perfect foils for each other and are both their own intentions and their opposition or their, you know, there's mm-hmm, so much mm-hmm. there. For the very first movie, which was made for $1 million, you can talk about how.
Was that the Roger Corman one?
The Roger Corman one.
Yes, the thing
with Roger Corman is he was racing a licensing fee, you know, or rights to it to get it done by this time under this budget. And that all came before the story, right? And then the first two movies was Fantastic Four
and the others,
and Rise of the Silver Surfer. They came in my opinion, they came really close. But again, they were just slightly ahead of their time. If you took those scripts, maybe punched them up a little bit, and use the CGI available now, I think they would be middle of the pack MCU movies.
Mm.
And then the Miles, it wasn't Miles Davis. It was that would have been a whole different movie, baby.
Yeah, truly.
I forget Miles' last name, but his Fantastic Four, when he was Reed Richards, they took a lot of compositional risks. I respect that movie. It too many risks, you know, and it became a compelling sci-fi movie that wasn't a Fantastic Four movie. You know, whenever I write Mallory and Gunner, I've got to reset who they are. Miles Teller was the name.
Yes, I just pulled it up. Miles Teller, and Michael B. Jordan, and Kate Mara. Yeah.
And they all played characters really well. And Michael B. Jordan was a great Human Torch. And I thought Kate Mara was a great Sue Storm. Miles Teller was interesting. It's hard to really nail Reed Richards. It really is. Dr. Doom was where we went way off base. And the guy who did The Thing, I thought his performance was great. I think people are not going to accept the Ben Grimm The Thing until CGI can make the ever-loving blue-eyed Thing. Mm. And I think the big mistake is, you know, some fans are thinking it's going to look just like Benji does in the comics. And what we've seen throughout the greatest of the Marvel movies is that going completely 100% like the comic books looks corny, and grounding it more makes it work better. And I think one of the things with this is that there wasn't enough fans that were willing to take the journey with them. You know, that's the first movie where Marvel movie where the fans really felt privileged.
Great.
You know, and we're going to just rip this apart. Hell with you. Yeah. And you watch it now, I think you can see a basically strong story in there. And then some of the visuals, Doom, some of the let's take it this much further. Let's mix in, you know, the forbidden world. So you didn't, they overreached and complicated it. Not so much serving the story as trying to put their imprint. I think that's what, especially with movies where it's more of a group dynamic. I think a lot of times movies get ruined by everyone trying to put their thumbprint on that. This is what I'm going to add to it instead of what's going to make the movie better.
Serve the story.
You know, serve the story. Go watch Guardians of the Galaxy. All three movies are well written, well thought out, and then well executed. I happened to see Guardians 1 yesterday, I think. And it's an old enough movie where we're not spoiling, right? So
I would hope so.
The Chris Pratt character, Pete Quill, movies opens up with him being like about 10, 12, around there somewhere. 8 or 10, I forget. And his mom's dying right in front of him in the hospital. And she says, "Give me your hand, Peter. Give me your hand." And he won't, whether he's angry at him. He's very much an authentic kid there. But this marks him and drives him, right? Well, at the climax of the movie, where Peter Quill does the most dangerous thing in the world, you know, the most dangerous thing possible out of heroics, and he grabs something that should kill him and is in the process of killing him, Gamora reaches out her hand and says, "Take my hand, Peter," which is exactly what she doesn't know, but it's exactly word for word what her mom says. Mm-hmm. He even flashes on his mom. And it's a great moment. But way later in the third movie, right, Gamora has been killed, spoiler, in Endgame, right? Was it Endgame? Yeah. Or was it? No, it was Infinity Gauntlet.
Infinity War, yeah.
Infinity War, right? Now there's a different universe, one of the first hints of the multiverse. Different universe Gamora is running around with no memory of their relationship and no memory of that moment. Take my hand, Peter. And Quill cannot get over losing her. And you might think in that third movie, come on, bro. You've been with multiple girls of throughout the galaxy. All sorts of girls. You even said about that in the first movie. And when I saw her say, "Peter, take my hand," I understood why he couldn't get over her, couldn't let it go. And it takes the whole third movie for him to make peace with that. And I realized when he makes peace with her, with Gamora being gone, even that person standing in front is not his Gamora, and makes peace with that, he also finally makes peace with the loss of his mother and not taking his mother's hand. He forgives himself. And in a really subtle way, three movies through, that is carried all the way through very organically. That
again, that's the writers and the other parties involved paying attention.
Pay attention. Serve the story. You are right, yep, sir.
That's it. Okay. So on that note, we will say it's been a while. Again, guys, you know, always we have our opinions, we have our feelings, our thoughts about these things. Go see it. You know, go see the movies if you haven't seen them already. Let us know what you think about it. You know, serve up your opinions as well. We're more than interested to hear them. And I think next time we'll talk about a couple of other films that have appeared on the horizon that I think we'd like to sort of explore and talk about. Serving the story and talk about, again, the power of really developing great characters. Yeah. Because that's what we go to see. The pretty pictures, the special effects, that's nice. But we really go to go on that ride of the story with these characters. Mm-hmm. And that's what you've got to develop in your stories, is great, compelling characters that make us want to take that journey with them.
And there's nothing better during the summer. I'm going to sit back and talk about stuff like this.
Yep.
So it stays with our summer theme, you know.
Yep. Summer dreaming.
Summer dreaming, baby. Talking okay, about it, so seeing what it works.
We'll see you next time. Oh, and Chris will be making a few more announcements the next time.
Things are happening, baby.
Got a couple
things
happening. Some stuff happening.
Took a long time. It was like long birth. My mom used to complain that she was in labor for 21 hours with me. And I owed her a karmic debt for that, you know. And I might have been paying it off these last few months, because it was really, really, really long and slow and painful to get things to fall into the right place for the announcements I'm gonna be able to make very, very soon.
Excellent. Looking forward to it, Chris. You take care, brother.
Thank you very much. Peace, everybody. I hope it's helpful. I know we started silly. I hope we got some meat for you.
Okay. Take care.
Peace.